Much of the matter in these earlier talks is included in previous chapters. In the following chapter 1 I'm recording one that Sis gave, and I'm presenting it in Sis' own words. I wish to bring to your notice three communicators who have appeared to us, and I would like to bring them to you in just the way that they came to us, because the manner of their coming seems to me, at least, to be more or less evidential. The appearance of one of these shows a unique personality, and I am going to describe it before giving the only message I have received from him, which, suddenly discontinued over a year ago, has been just lately as suddenly resumed and completed. It was early in our work, while we were still experimenting with Uia, that a friend sat opposite me at the board, while F. R., nearby, wrote down the letters as they appeared. Uia had been very unreasonable that evening, giving us only a jumble of words and sentences, so that when it spelled the same group of letters without pause three times, F. R. thought it only another piece of foolishness. Hail Vans, hail Vans. Still, we went on. But when it spelled as Weedish, then alone C, followed by He Missed, F. R. exclaimed, "This is just nonsense. We can't get anything tonight." My friend, however, looked at the paper then for the first time, and had a sudden inspiration. "Why," she said, "that spells a Swedish chemist." And above, concealed in the three times repeated letters, was evidently his name, Hale Evans. We did not hear the Swedish chemist laugh, as he undoubtedly did, but afterward when we spoke of his puzzling advent, he wrote through my pencil, "Yes, I nearly missed the trick that time." He said little that first evening, except to declare that what was known of chemistry on Earth was but child's play compared to the science as revealed in the life beyond. But some time later he came again saying that he wished to give a message. And the message was begun, but it proved a very difficult one for me to take as it was quite out of my line of thought. Also, the Swedish chemist proved an exacting and, as I thought, impatient personality, often disappearing after a sentence or two, because not satisfied with my transcription. Finally, I too, grew impatient, and wished no more of this exacting Swede. After a number of evenings, and when there had been several pages of the message written, Hale Evans disappeared, and for more than a year his writing remained unfinished. Finally one evening I said, "I believe I will ask to have another communicator from that sphere finish the message of Hale Evans." This brought the chemist to the fore again, and, an evening or two later, my pencil wrote, "I am here. I will tell you what I wish. It is to have you finish my message in words of my own choosing." Hale Evans, after one or two ineffectual attempts, he rapidly finished it. When it was done he wished me to read the entire message for his correction. This I did, and he altered a few words and phrases and omitted some sentences. So now I am able to read the message to you with the corrections of its author. The second personality added a few sentences to Hale Evans' message in an explanatory way, and, as I wish to read the message with his additions, I will introduce him before commencing. In the first place I am going to ask you how clear a memory you would have of people whom you met casually, and only once, 25 or 30 years ago. They come and go, do they not? A moving throng, scarcely leaving an impression on your brain. That, at least, is my experience, and that is why the coming of this second personality seems also to me to belong among the evidential occurrences. One evening several pages of exceedingly interesting matter was written, ending rather abruptly with, "That is all for now. Who am I? Do you know?" "No, I haven't the slightest idea." "Are you anyone whom I have known?" "Try to think of the name of a teacher of natural history in a college of your home state." "Well, Professor Agassiz is the only name I think of now." "Professor Agassiz was a noted teacher, and I should be proud to own the name, but I am not he." "You say you taught in a college?" "Yes, and not at Harvard." "Do you mean Williams College?" "Yes, that is the one. I knew one A.S., of Williams College, but I think he was a student rather than a teacher. I am not he, but I knew him well. I am sure I do not know who you are. I spent some days once in your hometown and heard you at the organ in church. Oh, I wonder if you are the friend who visited Mr. N. once?" Yes, now you have it. I remember taking a ride one afternoon when you were in the party, the only time that I met you. If you are the one I have in mind, you went to Florida shortly afterward, but did not live long?
Yes, I went there, and only lived a short time afterward.
You have been on that side a long time, then?
Yes, a long time, and am only a beginner in learning yet. Now I will introduce number three, as the three all have a part in the message I am about to read. Some of you may have seen the articles in the Cosmopolitan magazine, written by Basil King, in which he gives some interesting philosophy received from an intelligence whom he called Henry Talbot, stating that this name was used to hide the real identity of the transmitter. I read all the articles, and afterwards wondered many times who the wise Henry Talbot might be. One evening it occurred to me to ask of the one who seems to be our special instructor, if she could tell me the real name of Henry Talbot. My pencil wrote slowly, W-I-L-L-I-A. And then, as I saw it was going to write William, I drew my hand away, because I had somehow thought of Talbot as among the great names of the past, and no such ordinary name as William appeared to me to be right. There was a pause of a few seconds and then my hand was moved down the page a little and wrote, he was a teacher of psychology. My brain did not connect the two until F. R. looked at the writing and said, William, teacher of psychology? William James, of course. I hardly believed that I had the name correctly, and turned to the pencil for information, asking our instructor, Mary Bosworth, if the name had been given to us correctly. The pencil wrote, I will call him if you wish. After a short pause it again wrote, this is Henry Talbot, and I am William James. What can I tell you to convince you of my identity? You were just now thinking of my book, The Will to Believe. That book seems rubbish to me now, for here all doubt is forever set at rest and clear understanding prevails. The mention of his name had brought the book to my mind. In your communications to Basil King you talked about the souls of inanimate things. Was that received correctly? I am not sure, he wrote, for I did not read the copy afterwards. I suppose I have something of the poet's feeling for the lower orders of creation. But I ought to differentiate that feeling from the absolute truth perhaps, because the life in these inanimate things does not reach up to intelligent beings and to the immortality of the soul. You will realize though, a certain consciousness, shall we call it intelligence ? In vegetable forms, in their pushing toward the light, and in their search for water, and in the vine that reaches out for support that may be far away. What this intelligence is I do not know, but something there is in every living thing that betrays some sign of consciousness. It was that I was trying to express. After commenting on this I said, I remember that you use the word rhythm many times in speaking of that life. Will you tell me just what you meant by it? It is a meaning that I cannot convey readily to human perception. It belongs to the vibrations that we become conscious of here, but a consciousness gained only on this side. I asked Mary once, I said, what rhythm meant as applied to that life, and the answer of the always practical and sensible Mary was, rhythm is a term used by transcendentalists, maybe they know what they mean, but we don't. Mary has a lot of good, hard sense. Trust her and go ahead. While all this was interesting, there was nothing that established the identity of Henry Talbot. But some months later we learned that a Boston newspaper had published the statement that Henry Talbot was Professor William James, and, from other information that we have received, there remains no doubt of the truth that they are one and the same personality. And now, after this long preamble, I will read Hale Evans' message. I desire to say first, that I wish you to have the open mind, without preconceived ideas. I will explain as I go along. First, then, is the cosmos itself, and the particles composing the cosmos. The smallest portions of matter are what you call electrons. We here call them grains of force. These ultimate particles are infinitesimal portions of universal force, and are united by some power to create an atom. From atoms molecules are formed. There are also segregated atoms. These are the beginnings of individual life. The creation of the life atom is due partly to electricity, yet the great first cause is behind and beyond all life, all atoms, all grains of force. I will begin with the cosmic forces as we find them on the Earth planet. Let me explain the word cosmos, for it contains everything in life, big or little, and is the world and the universe as well. Forces, greater than the mind can conceive, are constantly building in the great unknown spaces. The grains of force that belong to chemical action are not the source of life, but are the foundation of the material world. The source of life is far more spiritual even than these invisible particles, and is the gift of the great creator of us all. A starting point is hard to find, for life is elusive, that is, the germ of the life principle. What I can do is to take the given quantity, the life germ, and build from that. This life germ, once established, goes on in infinite gradations, through mollusk to animal, through animal to man, through man to spirit. After spirit comes immortality and endless progression. To begin with the living organism in its first inception, we must go back in the scale of creation, further back than you are aware, because the germ of life belongs to the invisible creations that even microscopic examinations have failed to reveal. Among these infinitely small forms is one that bears within the germ of the human life. Cast out on the sea of life, it changes, enlarges, and multiplies, until a mollusk lies within its shell. From this unthinking, unseeing form, in the evolution of the ages, comes a slightly higher creation, with sight and intelligence somewhat developed. After this, the upward climb goes steadily on, until fish and ape reach the final goal in man. From man onward and upward is the intensest part of life history, for here begins the prophecy of a glorious future, together with the constant backward pull of his progenitors. Here, then, is the great battleground of life, animal instincts, selfishness, ferocity, over against the fine forces of spirit, the eternal struggle between the animal and the spiritual. There are many steps in this progress upward to man and spirit and the life immortal. What does the mollusk feel, for instance? Where does intelligence separate from instinct? Where does spirit begin? These are some of the questions of life processes. When the mollusk turns in its shell to seek for food, when the vertebrate begins to care for its young, when in ages upon ages a conscience appears, and a human heart begins to beat semicolon, then the faint, first hint of the immortal life begins. All this is the preparation of unnumbered ages. Millions of years have been absorbed in the process. What, then, must be the value of the soul, if the cost be so indescribable? Yet the birth of the soul is only the beginning. Poor and weak at first, filled with evil impulse and selfish thought, it is only a shade above the animal, yet it holds the promise of immortal life. But, just as a pugilist grows strong by hard knocks, just as courage develops from fear, just as manliness overcomes weakness, and loyalty outrides treason, and principle is born out of sin semicolon, so the soul, through its many strifes, emerges from its base surroundings, and begins its long and evolutionary progress towards immortality. There are many small unseen influences at work upon the soul, for you must know that a part of every human life is beyond the seen in the mortal, and belongs to the unseen in the immortal. This is the life of the spirit which emanates from the soul. This organ that we call soul is invisible, for the scalpel of the surgeon has never found it, nor the eyes of the clairvoyant seen it. But it is the invisible, and powerful for good or evil, for the soul is not always good nor always intelligent, it is educated along with the body. In the formative condition which leads to the immortal life, the mind must begin its more spiritual task of creating new desires, new motives, and new activities, allowing the soul to grow out of its selfishness into unselfish service, allowing the thoughts to dwell in purer atmosphere, and life to assume a finer development. And thus gradually, sometimes through suffering, sometimes through loss, a few times through happiness, the soul comes into its own. Yet it arrives here as it left the earth plane. No miracle has been wrought, no immediate entrance into infinite knowledge or infinite joy. But even as the mortal slowly evolved from lower to higher, so the soul progresses onward and upward. How can I describe its progress? Could a butterfly tell the chrysalis of its flight? Could a bird make the creeping things of earth understand its passage through the air? Could a 20th century scientist make a caveman realize the wonders of electricity, of the wireless, of radium, or of the X-ray? How can one of this sphere do other than give impressions of spirit life? Vague, perhaps, indefinite, as the critics say, but still impressions, like shadows of the real, or like a chord of music that preludes faintly the harmony to follow. So then, having outlined the evolution of life from invisible forms to visible man, from mortal man to immortal spirit, I will leave still another impression with you of this life. But how can I give it except in phrases that you can understand? Joyous activity, increasing knowledge, loving companionship, and, finally, an ever-growing comprehension of the infinite, all-pervading wisdom and love. After this message was at last completed, I read it loud one evening to F.R. He said it seemed to him good, yet he imagined the critical ones would say that, after all, the description of the unseen life was still vague and indefinite. Soon my hand gave the usual signs of wishing to write, and taking the pencil, this came from the Williams College professor: "I have listened to the reading of Hale Evans' message, and know the criticism that you and others feel, that it leaves this life too vaguely described. Yet Hale Evans is right in saying that only impressions can be given. Some impressions are clearer than others, however, and I will try to give one that seems to me to present a more definite picture of this place. Will you tell me what constitutes beauty of place or scenery?" The question surprised me, and I wondered why, when I was expecting some description of that afterlife, he should talk of scenery. I did not in the least guess that this question, as well as others that followed, concealed a striking illustration or argument. It was certainly not from my mind. "From whose mind then? Can you tell me?" But I answered his question, that I loved the mountains, valleys, forests, rivers, etc. "Yes," he wrote, "all these are here. But tell me, what to you is the ideal scenery?" "Oh, perhaps the wild, mountain scenery, canyon, cataract, or wooded hill." Still he persisted. "Will you answer what appeals to you most, the wild and rugged, or the restfulness of valley or grove?" I thought a little and answered that if I wished my soul to be startled into reverent admiration, I would choose nature's wonderlands, the Grand Canyon of the Colorado, the mighty Alps, perhaps the awe-inspiring volcano of Kilauea. Or, if I wished rest and repose, I would like the quiet valley, shady grove, or murmuring stream. "Thus, you see," he then said, "the scenery is, to your mind, beauty as it appeals to some inner sense, and you have now given the key to heavenly beauty and surroundings. It must express some feeling or thought, if it is to represent beauty to you." "Do you mean that it is only a thought, heaven?" "Not that exactly, but the thought or desire brings one to that which corresponds to that thought. You desire a home and the quiet places where thought may dwell. Such a home you would build, because thought forces are the creative power here. Then your soul would desire to expand and be uplifted in contemplation of grandeur, and you would go to the grandeur of mountain, sea, or sky, and lose yourself in the vastness and majesty before you. Again, in your heart of hearts, you would like the nearness of congenial companionship, and the grace and beauty of exquisitely fine surroundings, and these two would be yours." "Can you get my thought at all?" "I think you mean that the surroundings correspond to one's desires?" "That is nearly the thought. The one word harmony might express it all." This was all from the professor, but to my surprise, William James appeared, saying that he would like to add his testimony to what had been said of impressions of spirit life. "Spirit is one thing," he wrote, "matter another. Do not expect to measure both in the same way. Your professor friend is trying to make your earth language convey a little more clearly the impression of the life here. We are puzzled how to get over to earth life the beauty and harmony of this one. Where all are tuned to the same vibrations, there can be no discordant notes. You are musically in tune with the great composers, and you will know what I mean when I say that to be in tune with the heavenly vibrations means a harmony undreamed on earth. It means a readjustment of the earth-born faculties. It means that the follies of earth thought are replaced by the wisdom of this sphere. It means that the wisdom of earth thought is merged in heavenly knowledge. It means that the transient loves of earth are replaced by loves and friendships so fine as to bear no resemblance to the fleeting ties of earth. Have I added anything to the clearness of the description? This was all at this time, but in closing I would like to add one more word from Professor James, who came a few evenings later with this: I have a word to say to earth people, if I can get it through as I wish. It is that the earth is full of mystery. Every plant that grows, every wave of the ocean, every star that shines, has its own hidden mystery. Life, the life of the spirit, is God's mystery, and God's blessing, and its richest blessings are here in the unseen. Why, then, turn away from this greatest and best of all mysteries? Why not come into closer touch with this incomparably great and unseen life? Appendix 249. These stories are for the mothers who have lost little children. Tell them for me, if they could know the love and tenderness that surround those little ones here, they would not grieve so much. There are many teachers here, comma loving spirits, all of them comma to whom is given the care of little ones who have come to this side without their parents. The stories given here are only one of the ways in which they are cared for and educated. D. Children's stories received and arranged by Sis. In the wave of psychic interest which had swept over the world during and since the Great War, many bereaved ones have found comfort, and many believe they have received communications from their loved ones, and have become assured of future companionship in a life where war is banished and sorrow unknown. A multitude of books has appeared, many apparently inspired by those who have met the great change, yet still can look earthward, still can tell of their passing, and their awakening in that strange new life. The soldiers who gave their all, the scholars who left their books, the great minds who have long been on that further side semicolon all send some news of that spirit world, some description of its laws, occupations and interest. Yet, one field of inquiry has been left, for the most part, vague or undescribed. This is concerning the kind of life that opens out for children, for the little ones who have passed over without their parents. When, after many months of silence, D came to us, the veil between the two worlds seemed to grow transparent. At first it was enough to know that she lived, comma lived with her own personality, only intensified and made more beautiful. Then we began to ask questions concerning that life and its unfoldment to her, and soon we wished to know of her occupations. One evening we asked if she could tell us of her work. The reply came quickly: "Can you believe that I am developing into a teacher?" "We surely can," we replied, "but will you tell us just how and what you are teaching?" "I am teaching little children at present, and love the work. I tell them stories that have a lesson in them. Something like kindergarten work?" "Yes, and I love it, for the children are so quick to learn, and so loving, too. I like to mother the little things, so that they may not miss too much the care and tenderness of the mother left on earth. Can you give us some idea of the way you teach them?" "I will try." Today it was in this way: "Once upon a time," I told them, "there was a beautiful fairy who took little children to a wonderful garden where they could play. Then the fairy told them of a new game. And here I tell it to them, pretending to quote the fairy's words. And so I draw them into all sorts of little, new, educational thoughts, by clothing the thought in a story. Sometimes I describe animals on earth, and they are much interested because they have never seen them here. You would love to see me trying to represent lions and tigers. But I do not tell them they would harm little children, because evil is not known to them. No thought of cruelty must be allowed to enter their minds." This description of her work made us wish to hear more. And one evening she gave us the following: "My children are always the dearest work that I have, and I hope that I shall never stop teaching them. Would you like to hear about today's lesson?" I wished to tell them a story of activity in work, so I described the little things of earth, like the ants and bees and other busy little creatures. The children wanted to know what they were like, and I tried to tell them, but I could not quite make them understand. Then I tried to make pictures of them, but as I am no artist, that was not much better. So I finally said that the ants crawl and the bees fly. Then immediately we had a crawling, flying crowd of children that completely overwhelmed their teacher, and she called a halt to the lesson and joined in the fun. Again, When we asked for a kindergarten story, she told us the following: "Today I called a tiny child to come to me, and when I had her in my arms, I placed my hand on her head and said to the other children, 'Now this, where my hand is a beautiful house that we are going to furnish, and you may tell me what we should put in it.' One said, 'There must be a big room full of love,' opening her arms as if she would enclose the universe. Another declared that we must put in kind thoughts for other children who had no mothers here. Another said we could make a playroom in the house, and play games, and see pictures of all those queer animals on earth. Another thought, we might have a little mother's room, where we could mother other little children as you mother us. I said, 'Do you think the rooms in this beautiful house are all filled now?' One replied, 'Wouldn't love fill all the others?' 'Pretty near it,' I said, 'but how about truth and knowledge and growth?' 'Why, each of these could have a room, too,' they said. And the little child in my arms began to feel of her head to find where all these rooms could be. We asked once if she did not have many children come to her who had been wrongly taught, or not at all, and therefore had only false ideas and impressions. My pencil wrote, 'Most of them leave their false impressions with their bodies. One of the children here was a child of criminal parents, and came over poisoned by wrong teaching, but the influence here was so good and so gentle that she soon outgrew the other impressions. I think she would have drifted into a criminal life if she had been left on earth. Here, she is very dear and good. If every child had been surrounded by right influences, what would have happened? Most of them would have been good, I think, and their influence over the actually bad would have held evil actions in check. The work of my life nearly always has been in music, and the part of it that I have liked best has been the direction of choruses and choirs. Yet I was greatly surprised when D on that unseen side drew a lesson from even this circumstance. Can you guess what I talked to my children about today?" She wrote one evening, "I told them that you were my friend on earth, and I told them how you loved music. Then they wanted to try to sing, and I wish you could have heard them. They made many sweet sounds, but no time and no harmony. Then I described how you used to beat time to have us sing together. Then they all tried that. I thought they were very dear, trying to follow my motions and keep together. The lesson was, of course, unity in action, and that to work together in harmony meant better and bigger things than for each to try separately. I think the idea appealed to them and increased their desire for united and harmonious action. I do so love the work with the children, and their quick responsiveness to my thought. I am teaching them about unselfishness now, and how to send their thoughts out to others in kindness and love. Sometimes a newly arrived child feels desolate and lonely without the sheltering protection of a mother's arms. Then the children can be of the greatest service in surrounding the little one with love and tender thought. There are many ways in which children can learn the true office of unselfishness and love, and their gentle and loving attentions to others react upon themselves in added happiness. I wish you could see them, all so dainty and light and beautiful. Today we walked in the garden looking at the flowers. Then we tried to find the colors that each liked best, and each picked out her favorite color. One chose a pink flower, and said that was for love. Another chose white, because that to her was like the baby angels. Another gathered purple flowers because her mother had loved that color. Dearest of all was the little blue flower that stood for hope and happiness, they said. And so we went through the garden, picking flowers and telling what they meant, until we had nearly all the virtues represented, but no faults. When I asked where the faults were, they said, 'Why, flowers have no faults.' Then I called them my flowers, and told them that they, too, must be without faults if they would belong in the beautiful garden of love. Ah, dear mothers of little children, I wish you could see these happy ones at play in these wonderful gardens. Can you not think of them so, rather than taken from you and borne to some faraway unknown place?" Then after a while came a serious story. Many years ago a boy told his mother that he was going to be a great man, and that he would have riches and power, and make others do as he wished. Well, the years went by, and the boy grew to manhood, and he did attain power and riches and the gift of controlling others, but in far, far different ways from his own boyish plans. He did have power, but power born out of suffering and disappointment. He did have riches, the riches of a spirit made pure by loss. And he did control others, through the power of love and sympathy.